Good. Thank you, Yong Beck, for the kind introduction. That's actually the second time somebody has mentioned that my proudest achievement, which is the number one paper on the CONMED archive. Okay, so no one can contest that. All right. So today I'm going to try to review in a broad way a lot of recent work in quantum condensed matter theory, but also introduce some of the connections to string theory that have been of much interest in the last few years. I'm going to try to do it most of the talk without writing any equations except one or two small ones, just to get the basic idea across. And hopefully, if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt any time. Okay. All right. So the standard, if you open a textbook on solid state physics, all of it is in some sense building on what I would call the Sommerfeld block theory, which really explains in a very successful way almost any metal insulator or superconductor. And here, when I'm talking about matter, I mean electronic matter mostly, where I'm thinking about electrons being the active degree of freedom, which is responsible for all of these properties. And the underlying principle in our theories of metal insulators, superconductors, superfluids, so on, is essentially one of adiabatic continuity, that we take some simple limit in which you can think of the particles or pairs of particles as essentially independent, where we can write down some simple wave function. And then we assume that the effect of interaction is to not destroy that independent particle state in any fundamental way. So just to very quickly review, the theory of band insulators is you have single electrons occupying some states labeled by momentum. And when all states are full, you get an insulator. And when there is a boundary between empty and filled states, then you get a metal because you can have easy transport of charge across the Fermi energy. And when these electrons pair with each other and those pairs both condense, you get a superconductor. So that within 2 minutes is the entire solid state physics course that you can then study more about and how you move away from these very simple cartoon pictures to beautiful predictions about real properties of many, many materials. However, much of the interest in condensed matter in the last 20, 30 years has been to really move beyond this all-too-successful paradigm. And one way to summarize that distinction is that we want to now think about states of quantum matter, of electrons mostly, which do not have this simple connection to independent particle states. And one buzzword that I'm going to put forward is that these are states there where the quantum degrees of freedom are really entangled with each other in a fundamental way. And I'm not going to define entanglement very precisely. It's basically that property which prevents it from being smoothly connected to the independent particle state. And this is actually, and it's for good reason I'm not going to define it precisely. I'll come up with various measures of it. It's really something that has not fully theoretically understood. What do we really mean by quantum entanglement, and when is one state more entangled than the other? It's still a question of some debate. Okay, so let me just, however, introduce what I mean by entanglement, again, operationally. And another way to think about it, it's basically the principle of quantum superposition, that you can take superposition of physically distinct state and get a new state, but then we apply it to more than one particle. So the canonical example would be the EPR pair. So if we think of an electron and a hydrogen atom, and I just label it with its spin, then in a molecule, however, the two electrons are entangled with each other because when the electron one atom is up, then the other one is down, or vice versa. And this is kind of a non-classical correlation. It's not to say that this electron is up and that's down. It's simply that they are correlated in a way which you can only figure out by measuring the state of one electron that automatically determines the state of the other one. So this basic principle of entanglement was something that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rozon found really unpalatable because of their argument that, well, what happened if you took this pair of entangled electrons and separated them far away? Then you'll have a non-local correlation between the measure of the state of this electron and the state of the other electron. And this is what now subsequently is called a paradox. This kind of non-classical correlation essentially instantaneous correlations between measurements really far apart. And really, the only natural conclusion from this kind of this paradox is that the idea of the concept of a quantum state is not local, that it's really there's just one quantum state which non-locally at the same time describes both electrons. Okay, so now we want to take this idea of non-locality in quantum correlations and really build it up, not for two electrons, but really all the way to an infinite number of electrons. And I'll give you examples of some simple states and actual materials that show these types of correlations, which we're starting to understand. So my talk will actually cover three separate topics. I've given you an introduction on quantum superposition and entanglement. Now I'm going to move towards the world that I usually live in, which is thinking about electrons moving in crystals. And I'll introduce what a quantum critical point is. And eventually, although implausible as it sounds, connect up, and I'll argue in a rather natural way, these ideas to ideas from string theory and black holes. Okay, so let me just begin now in still remain on solid ground and talk about electrons in crystals. So let's consider for definite this very simple Hamiltonian, a simple model, where you have electrons which are localized on these blue circles, which are sitting on the vertices of a square lattice. And the only thing that's active, that's free to move, is the spin of the electron, which can point in any direction it wants. And there's a coupling between the electrons, and this is my only equation for the most of my talk, which says that nearest neighbor electrons like to be antiparallel, so this J is positive. And so we want to figure out this is a quantum, the coupling between the quantum spin of one electron and the other one, and you want to determine the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And I'm going to introduce one tuning parameter, and that's going to be the parameter lambda. And lambda will differentiate some of the bonds in a way that the red bonds remain J and the dashed green bonds have a smaller value, J over lambda. So let's, and I'm just going to change lambda. So let's just look at first a simple limit that you can easily understand, and that's the limit of very large lambda. If lambda is very large, then the green bonds are essentially invisible, and then it becomes a pair of decoupled pairs of electrons, and now it's an undergraduate problem to figure out the ground state of S1 dot S2. Well, that's precisely the spin singlet state that we found in the hydrogen molecule. So there is some quantum entanglement between pairs of electrons connected by the red bonds. However, this electron is completely uncorrelated with this one, either classically or quantum mechanically, just a product of pairs. So there's entanglement, but it's really local. Okay, that's sort of what I've said. So if I were able to separate these two, then sure, I will see the EPR effect. But if I separated this one from this one, I'll see no correlations whatsoever. So this is a state called a quantum paramagnet because the spins are all locked up. There's no magnetism. If you apply a magnetic field, the response is exponentially small at low temperatures. And so this is a nice state that you can see in many experimental materials, as I'll show you in a minute. Now let's look at the opposite limit when lambda becomes 1. So at this point, there's no difference between the green and the red bonds. We don't know the exact ground state, wave function of this state. However, through various studies, you'll have to take my word for it, the ground state looks like this picture where you just think of the spins as classical objects. So if these were classical vectors and you wanted to minimize this energy, then there's an obvious solution where you make them point in opposite directions as on a chessboard. And then there's just left over a global degeneracy where you can rotate all of them by a common angle. So this kind of state is called an antiferromagnet or a nail state. And it's clearly very different from a paramagnet. If you apply a magnetic field, the spins can rotate, and so there is definitely a response. There's a broken symmetry, you've picked a definite direction, and so on. So this is a very different state. And it also has the property of having long-ring correlations, that if this spin is down, then an odd number of sites down, no matter how far I go, the spin would be up. So there's perfect correlations, But this is just a classical correlation. It's still a product of spins, is the ground state. And so this is, in fact, there's no entanglement at all in this very simple picture, since obviously it's a classical picture. Now, quantum mechanically, you correct this a bit, but not too much. And so again, this is a state that's adiabatically connected to some simple independent electron state, and there is no true long-range entanglement. Okay, so now what we know is that as a function of lambda, these two limits that I've described are separated by a very specific point that's known very, very precisely for this model called lambda c, and that's the quantum critical point, which I'll have more to say on in a minute. But before I go there, let me just turn to experiments to give you an example of some beautiful experiments on thallium copper chloride in which the analog of lambda can be tuned just by applying pressure on the crystal. So here's thallium copper chloride. It's a complicated three-dimensional crystal. It's nothing like the simple square lattice model that I wrote down. But it shares the feature that you have these copper spins, copper sites which have one unpaired spin, and then each copper atom has a preferred partner which is near it. And so at ambient pressure, the electrons on these two coppers form a singlet just like in a hydrogen molecule. And so at ambient pressure, this is in fact a quantum paramagnet, just like the model was at large lambda. Now, there are couplings, of course, between these different sides. Okay, which are these shown, which are weaker and shown by the dashed lines in this case. However, when I apply pressure, then just as happened for lambda close to one, you get a nail state with each spin having a definite polarization. And this is clearly evident from some neutron scattering data that I won't show at the moment. All right, so one way you can distinguish these two states, and I mentioned that just to get, so you get a picture of the difference between these two states, is to look at the excitations. So on the quantum paramagnet, if this is your ground state, to get an excitation, you break a bond and you get a spin triplet, as you would for any independent pair of spins. But because the green bonds are not exactly zero, this triplet can move around. So you think of that as a spin one particle that can move through the lattice. On the other hand, on the nail side, you have the analog of Goldstone modes of phonons where all the spins move together, and that's a spin wave, and that you can also see in neutron scattering. So here's, in fact, the more recent neutron scattering data of Ruegg et al., where under pressure, they look at the lowest energy excitation. And what they see then, at ambient pressure, this is this triplon spin one particle that you get in the paramagnet. And its energy goes down as you apply pressure until you reach the special critical point. And on the other side, above the critical pressure, you have the spin waves that I just showed you. But you also see something else, which I haven't anticipated so far, but which is theoretically anticipated, which is the analog of the Higgs boson. And you can make some claim to being the first observation of a Higgs boson. So this, you can think of this. This is not a joke. You can think of this as the modulation in the magnitude of the nail order. And in fact, its energy can be predicted from the energy on this side, and it appears exactly where it's expected. Anyway, so to get back then to our model, so what I've summarized for you are the structure of these two phases and how they're detected in experiments and how there's a quantum phase transition in between them, where these disparate excitations, the Higgs boson, the spin wave, the triplon, all seem to somehow become degenerate. So our focus now is then on this very special point, the quantum critical point between them. And, you know, if I could, I would draw a picture of the wave function, but I can't. This is the one point where really you have the first example of non-trivial long-range entanglement, that you have a rather complicated wave function which is not connected smoothly to any independent particle limit. It doesn't have any simple set of excitations like spin waves or Higgs bosons or anything. It's some rather complicated set of excitations, and we would like to understand more about it and also try to figure out how this these long-range entanglement affects the dynamic and various observable properties of this critical point. So in lieu of drawing a wave function for this particular state, I'll draw a picture which represents the wave function in what's called a tensor network. So think of each circle here as my spin, some spin, quantum degree of freedom. The spin can point up or down. And I want to now entangle these spins all with each other. And I do that in this hierarchical way. I take these pair of spins, entangle them somehow, and create some new degrees of freedom here. And then I decimate the degrees of freedom between these two to get a new composite spin and keep going. And so you can see now this spin is eventually entangled with that spin because they're connected in this network as you go further down. And so this axis here is depth of entanglement. This actually keeps going forever. So there's entanglement between spins infinitely far apart eventually. And that's the best I can do to draw a picture of the wave function. Okay, we'll come back to this picture in a bit. But that's one characteristic of the quantum critical point. It has long-range entanglement. Now, so this is actually a very general feature of many other types of complicated quantum states we want to understand in experiments. For this particular model on the square lattice, there's a number of other features that help us a bit. They are specific to this model, but let's just exploit them here anyway. So one of the special features of this model is that if you look at the low energy theory near this critical point, for this model, with no cheating, exactly this Hamiltonian, the low energy theory has an emergent relativistic symmetry. So it looks, it can be described by a field theory which is relativistically invariant. Now, of course, relativity has associated with the velocity of light, but here the velocity of light is replaced by a much smaller velocity, which is the velocity of spin waves. Okay. So that's true near the critical point at low energies, and I won't give you proof of it. If you want to learn more, there's a good book that you can look at. Okay, but there's another useful feature about this critical point, which is that right at the critical point is an even bigger symmetry, and this emerges generically, not just for this model, but for a wide class of models separating phases of the same basic characteristics. And that is the theory is invariant in the scale and conformal transformations of space-time. That is, I can stretch space and time in a way that I preserve all angles, and as long as I do that, the basic structure of the theory remains robust. And so such theories we call conformal field theories, and I put a 3 here to remind you that this is in 2 space and 1 time dimensions, so the dimension of space-time is 3. So this is a CFT3. And it's a highly non-trivial, strongly interacting CFT3. And really, that's one of the simplest and most studied examples we have of quantum states with long-range entanglement, so which is another reason for paying so much attention to it. So I call it a CFT3. Okay, so that concludes then my discussion of the very simplest and really the best understood quantum critical point of electrons in 2 dimensions, and how you get, for this case, a CFT3 at low energies. And this is then an example of long-range entanglement. Okay, so now I'm going to try to show you how these ideas are actually very naturally connected to ideas in string theory for now, and black holes will eventually make an appearance. Okay, all right, so let me try to show you. All right, so what is string theory? Well, it's a theory of strings, and that's the end of the story. No. the string theory was originally invented as a way of unifying the standard model of particle physics with gravity, and in that sense, it's been it's really the only success we have, only successful theory we have which can do both things, that it can get all the strange kinds of quarks and gauge fields that you have and chiral symmetry breaking that you have in ordinary standard model, and combine that consistently, at least in principle, with gravity. And various, so you think of the strings as excitations moving through space-time, and various vibrations of the string corresponds to gauge fields, quarks, gravitons, and so on. Okay, so that's one use of string theory, and that's often been the most important use for many, many years. But string theory is eventually discovered that's this theory of elementary particles has many other interesting phases. That the same theory can define a consistent theory in many different regimes. And one different regime is what string theory does near what's called a D-brain. So you can imagine a phase of string theory where there is of soliton-like object. Think of it as some, you know, like a field theory can have a vortex sitting there, and then near the vortex you have new types of physics. So here the strings move in, you know, 10 space-time dimension, but it can just happen there's a vortex-like or a defect in space-time, which is called a D-brain. And this D-brain extends over all of D, little d, dimensional space. And that defect has a property that strings can end on it. And so the ends of the string stick on it, and then then you have a theory of how these strings are moving around, connected to the surface, this defect in space-time. So we want to now focus in on this D-brain and look at some of its properties. So what is known about such excitation, such phases of string theory? One very important feature is that if you stick to the D-brain and just look at the motion of these particles, then it turns out to be described by a theory which doesn't have any gravity in it. So gravity was the original motivation for writing down string theory, but here, if you're just looking at the low energy theory on the D-brain, you get a theory of essentially electron-like objects with interactions that are not that dissimilar from the interactions you might have for electrons and crystals, at least broadly speaking. I mean, for electrons and crystals, gravity is absolutely unimportant. So it's not a significant force at all. So that's okay. So here, too, there's no long-range gravitational force. Another remarkable discovery, and there's many people who contributed to this. I'm not competent or knowledgeable to acknowledge everyone, but many string theorists, in particular Witten, Maldacena, Polchinski, and so on, some of the great names who pointed out that if these strings in this higher dimension here are moving in a space called anti-de Sitter space, so this is a space in four, the four means it's four space-time dimension. Anti-de Sitter is just telling you something about the curvature of the space in this direction. So the four refers to the following. You have two spatial dimensions here where these blue dots are moving around. Think of them as electrons in crystals. So that's two dimensions of space. There's one extra dimension, which is the emergent direction, and there's time. So that's where the four comes from. So the strings are moving in this four-dimensional space, which has a certain type of curvature. Then in that case, the low-energy theory on this D-brain is, again, this object we've already met. It's a conformal field theory in two space and one time dimension. So this turns out to be, you know, one of the most beautiful ways of realizing a solvable conformal field theory, that you can say something about this conformal field theory in great detail. So the conformal field theory I wrote down before, you know, we know something about it, but there are many things about it we do not know how to solve. So here you can view this as the analog of the Bethe-Ansatz, so the people who know those things, which is a solvable model in one dimension. They looked like very special solvable models, but they taught us a lot on one-dimensional quantum physics. And so here the hope is the same. Okay, we've found a solvable model, and so the frustrated theorists, anytime they find a solvable model, well, let's solve it and see what we can predict, and hopefully it has something to do with the real world. So we're just moving with that hope, but we have at least found a point of connection, the CFT3s, that emerge from this picture of string theory and this phase of string theory. Okay, so now I want to also go back to this tensor network picture. In the tensor network picture, you had your electrons sitting in this two-dimensional D will be two space here, and this was a way of writing on the wave function of these electrons, which are entangled by this tensor network. And I want to draw an analogy between this picture and this picture here. Here, again, you have these electrons moving in this two-dimensional space, and they're connected by strings. So you can now think of these strings as the object that allows you to build a complicated wave function that has non-long-range entanglement. So the strings are just the tool we have for building states with long-range entanglement. Those pictures are essentially the same. So you can think of this direction as the emergent. So that's the physical meaning of this emergent direction. It's a way of representing the hierarchical entanglement of your degrees of freedom. And this picture, I mean, this point was made by Brian Swingle. Okay, so that's nice. Those are nice pictures. But is it more than just some accidental coincidence between pictures that look the same? Well, there's a little bit more to it than that. And to do that, I want to introduce another quantity called the entanglement entropy, which is one way of measuring the entanglement. So here's, this is now my two-dimensional space. I don't have my emergent direction anymore. And I just take my my system and divide it into regions A and B. And the entanglement entropy is a way of measure, is one measure, which has to be interpreted carefully, but it's a measure of the entanglement of the degrees of freedom in A to the degrees of freedom in B. And the way you define it is you just trace out all the degrees of freedom in B, then the quantum mechanics of region A is described by a density matrix, rho sub A. This is all at zero temperature. And the entanglement entropy is the usual entropy of this density matrix. So let's try to estimate or get some idea of how I would measure the entanglement entropy of this region A using this tensor network. So just very crudely, let's think of each line here as some link which is entangling the degrees of freedom near it. So you want to figure out how much is A entangled with B. So you might say, okay, let me just count the lines that go out of A. So let me just draw a surface here and count the number of lines that cut across the surface. So there's 8 of them, so 8 is a measure of my entanglement. But you see that most of those links actually don't really go out to B, they're just connecting A with itself. So that seems not quite right. It's overestimating entanglement. On the other hand, so if I go way down and then count how many links connect A with B, and count how many times I cross this surface, then now I'm going to get many links crossing on the side and then some crossing down. I'll have fewer crossing down, but clearly I can now reach some points in region B by more than one path. So anyway, this also seems like an overestimate. So it turns out, through a more careful argument, there's a just right surface, and the just right surface is the one that cuts the minimal number of links. And that's a measure of how much is A entangled to B. And this you can be shown more carefully by these more quantitative analysis of this tensor network. So it's the minimal surface that cuts the smallest number of links. If you go too far down, you cut too many. If you go too close, you cut too many. Now, remarkably, it turns out that same formula for the entanglement entropy came out of string theory through very different sort of reasoning by Ryue and Takenagi. And Ryue and Takenagi argued as follows. So here, this is a string theoretic picture of the same physics. Here's my d-dimensional system called Minkowski space because it's a flat space. Then here's my emergent holographic direction. And in this picture, space itself is shrinking as I grow out this way. And you can think of that shrinkage of space as similar to the fact that here in this tensor network picture, the number of degrees of freedom is thinning out. So condensed matter physicists like to keep space as it is and remove degrees of freedom, whereas string theorists are more presumptuous. They shrink space itself. But it's the same thing. So the shrinkage of space is a characteristic feature then of the anti-de Sitter space. So now if I want to compute entanglement and entropy here, you take a region A on this two-dimensional surface, and then you draw a surface that encloses that region A, and there's again an optimal surface, and that optimal surface has minimal area, and that's the Ryue Takenagi formula. So these pictures are really closely connected and show you really again the role of this extra dimension in anti-de Sitter space is to allow you to describe states with long-range entanglement on your quantum system of interest. Okay? All right, so... So there, I've taught you a little bit of string theory. That's about as much as I know. and also showed you how the idea of long-range entanglement allows you to connect properties, phases of string theory to certain quantum critical points of electrons and crystals, and they have the common feature that these are low energy limit of both the string theory near a deep brain and electrons and crystals are described by the CFT3. That's really the driving connection that starts this whole parallel between different regions of physics. Okay, so any questions so far, actually? Before, yes?
I guess in the one picture of the network, in the holographic direction, how do you measure a metric in that?
Right. So, it turns out, so it goes, there's a scaling argument that allows you to figure that out. But in a sense, it's arbitrary because you can always redefine your distance along the R direction. And the final theory that you get has to be reparameterization invariant along that emergent direction. And that places certain constraints on the structure of the gravity theory. But there's a natural metric where it's dr squared over r squared because that makes everything scale invariant. Okay, yeah. Yeah. It can be multiply connected, especially if region A was multiply connected. But the minimal surface, if A is singly connected, then the surface is also, I think, yeah, always singly connected. Okay, so the final buzzword or final idea that I haven't introduced is black holes. Okay, where do black holes come in? So let's go back to our condensed matter system, where I've just so far, notice I've talked about the ground state and its excitations. So that's my one axis, my pressure or my lambda parameter, and I go from a nail state to a quantum paramagnet at some quantum critical point. So now I want to introduce another axis, and that's temperature. So I could spend a lot of time describing all the fun things temperature does, but here I just want to focus on some very basic ideas. So what you find is that you can divide what happens at finite temperature really very generally into two broad regions, and lots of detailed things happen in the two regions. So there's the blue region and the orange regions. Now, in the blue regions, you can roughly think of as just thermal excitations of the understood ground states on either side. So here we knew there was a very simple state, the nail state, and then there are spin wave excitations, and you get some bunch of them. And here you have thermally excited triplons. And the point is that we have well-developed theories and detailed understanding of what's going on in here based essentially upon classical pictures, because these excitations are, in the end, can be treated classically because they're defined in terms of wave functions that didn't have any fundamental long-range entanglement. So we don't want to focus on that here, so there's really essentially only short-range entanglement in this blue region. But we want to focus then on this orange region. And the orange region is where the fact that you had a long-range entangled state at zero temperature without any well-defined particle or wave excitation becomes really crucial. And so in this orange region, we have to think about the finite temperature dynamics of the excitations of this point. And so this is a challenging problem in condensed matter, which many of us have worked on over the years. But it's clear that this is there is no accurate theory, as far as we know, of the spin dynamics in this region where you have excitations of the ground state with long-range entanglement. One point deserves mentioning, which is that notice that this offending region, this difficult region, actually becomes broader as you raise the temperature, and that's because when the temperature becomes a bit higher, you become less sensitive to precisely what your value of lambda is. And the dominant excitations here are the excitations of the critical point at some higher energy scale. Anyway, okay, so this is the challenge, which has been addressed by many condensed matter theoretical approaches, but we don't know the accuracy of this, and also numerically by quantum Monte Carlo simulation is not possible, or so far not been possible, to obtain any sort of results in this region, even for this very simplest model. Okay, so that's where black holes come in. So let's now turn to our other crutch. Yes. Okay, it's not funny at all, as you'll see. Okay, right. So now let's go back to this picture of this deep brain with this anti-Disseter space emerging. This is my holographic direction. And now, as I told you, this is strings moving in this anti-Disseter space, another way of describing this quantum critical point. Now what I want to do is take this quantum critical point and raise it to non-zero temperature. So what happens, and I'm going to just state this, and I'll give you some, I'll state it without proof, but I'll give you some physical reasoning of why this is very natural. What you find is that when you raise this boundary theory to finite temperature, the so-called bulk theory, the theory that lives in this extra dimension, acquires a horizon. And it's a horizon similar to the surface of a black hole. Okay, so why is that reasonable? So let's go back and think about what are black holes. Well, of course, the idea of black holes has been around for many centuries. It's an object so massive that even light is not able to escape. And every black hole has a surface called the horizon, so that any light beam or any particle inside the horizon can never get out. And in Einstein's gravitational theory, the radius of the horizon is related to the Newton's gravitational constant, the mass inside the horizon, and the velocity of light. Okay. Right? Okay. So this was understood already, I guess, in the late 20s, that there are such solutions of Einstein's equations. And the next big step didn't happen until 1974, where Bekenstein and Hawking started thinking about, well, what does the quantum mechanics imply to what happens near the horizon of a black hole? And they were led to some really remarkable conclusions, which have since been really stood the test of time and turned out to be very fundamental to many developments in string theory, and I claim also to this correspondence with systems in condensed matter physics. So to understand this, let's go back again to this canonical example of entanglement. So where Einstein pointed out if you separated these two spins, there'd be long-range correlations between their states. Now imagine doing that with the two spins across the horizon of a black hole. So you could imagine there could be a process where a hydrogen molecule splits into two pieces. One falls inside and the other falls outside. And so now at this point, there is a quantum correlation. There's an entanglement between what's inside the black hole and what's outside. So it's not true they are totally disconnected with each other. There can be quantum correlations, EPR-type correlations, across a black hole horizon. So if you are now sitting outside, you have no way ever of without falling yourself inside the black hole, determining the state of the other part of the EPR pair, which is inside the black hole. So, okay, that I've already said. So there's an entangle between the inside and the outside, and one interpretation of this entanglement and the associated entanglement entropy is to, in fact, associate it with an actual entropy of the horizon of the black hole. So this entropy is called the Bekenstein arc entropy, and Hawking then later argued that associated with this entropy, there must also be a temperature called the Hawking temperature. Now, string theorists continue to debate the precise interpretation of this entropy and temperature, but I think that's, for now, a reasonable physical picture. That because of these quantum tunneling processes, to you outside, it seems as if there's a thermal finite entropy and temperature associated with the black hole. Now, in this correspondence, then, between my 2+1-dimensional quantum critical system at finite temperature, now what is the role of this entropy and temperature of the horizon? Well, it turns out that is precisely the temperature and entropy of my quantum critical system. So this is just the fact that I had an entropy here when I'm sitting in a theory without gravity, that same entropy is reinterpreted as the Bekenstein entropy of the horizon in the theory with gravity in this extra dimension. Okay, so that's one of the deep results that comes out of going back to work of Strominger and Wafa and many other people what happens when you take this conformal field theory and raise it to finite temperature. Furthermore, this is not just an ideal, it's great, you made a correspondence between thermodynamics of two different systems. It extends to more interesting dynamical properties too. In particular, the thing you might want to do here is perturb the spin and see how spin diffuses away or measure some conductivity or some viscosity. Then, as Damson originally pointed out, those properties of your quantum critical system, at least that's the way I'm interpreting it, can be recast as problems as how gravitational and other excitations interact with the horizon of the black hole. In particular, there's a one-sidedness of things going past the horizon, and that one-sidedness is precisely what gives you the dissipative coefficients or the frictional coefficients of your boundary theory. So this gives you then a way of doing computations in Einstein's theory of gravity in the presence of horizon, and really quite amazingly, relating them to things like diffusion constants and transport properties and viscosities of you know, electrons and crystals, these in off certain conformal field theories for sure. So this kind of approach, this is really the first connection and condensed matter type questions that that was made, and you know, I've worked on it quite a bit, and I won't say much more about it. It has led to new insights on this quantum critical dynamics, which I can tell you more about if you later if you want to talk to me. Okay, how am I doing on time? About 10 minutes. Okay, so then I've hopefully got across all the buzzwords on this slide, and you have some sense of the connections between them. They're all really connected in a very natural way. It's the long-range entanglement that ties together quantum critical points and string theory. There's two different ways of getting quantum states with long-range entanglement. And the black hole horizons have, again, a very deep connection to this quantum critical dynamics that you see of electrons and crystals at finite temperature. All right, so that's, you know, been intellectually certainly very satisfying to me to see, you know, see that things I was working on for 10 plus years is somehow connected to things I knew nothing about, but and also to these very deep ideas on the physics of black holes. But in the end, we are addressing some rather limited problems of, you know, some particular critical point and some strange antiferromagnet. And that's never satisfies people. So, but this is a encouraging sign. So let's see if we can push this analogy even further. So in the last 5 minutes, 10 minutes or so, I'll give you a little introduction to what most people, many string theorists and a few condensed matter theorists are working on these days, which is to try these, apply these ideas to cases where you have long-range entangled states at zero temperature, and really to try to understand the zero-temperature properties where you don't have conformal invariance at all. So let me try to introduce some of these problems and say a little bit about where things stand today in the few minutes available. So here's an example of a high-temperature superconductor, yttrium barium copper oxide. Its dominant excitations are the spins on the copper sites, which form a square lattice right here. But here's another high-temperature superconductor, more recently discovered, so-called iron pnictides. This is made up of, again, a square lattice now of iron rather than copper, and various other things that are outside the layer. Now, for this particular compound, here's a snapshot of a phase. Here's a beautiful phase diagram measured by this group of Matsuda. So here I'm varying, the horizontal axis is X, which is the relative concentration of arsenic and phosphorus. You can think of that as just some parameter that changes the lattice spacing. It's like lambda in the original model of pressure. It doesn't change the electron density in this case. And as you vary X, you get a number of interesting phases, so let's describe what they are. So one of them is something we've already met. It's the nail state, where the spins are half of them up and half of them down. In this particular material, it's not precisely a checkerboard pattern, but doesn't matter. It's basically the same type of state. It's also not a metal. I'm not an insulator, it's a metal, but that's a detail we won't go into. And then what else do we have? Then out low over here, we have a superconductor. In a way, that's part of the reason for the interest. It's a relatively high-temperature superconductor. And we could think of this, as I said in the beginning of my talk, as just a Bose condensate of pairs of electrons. So again, although it's a very interesting phase, there is no deep question in principle of, you know, what state are we talking about. It's some short-range entangled state. Now, so if you go to somewhat higher temperatures then, what you see are other types of behavior. So this region here, which is roughly in black, is where the resistance goes as T squared. So this, the color is represent alpha, the exponent, and the temperature dependent on the resistivity. And here you have T squared behavior, and that's the behavior in the Sommerfeld block theory, where you have occupied and empty states, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. Then if you now look at what happens near this Fermi energy, which is defined by a Fermi surface in momentum space, then the scattering of electrons across that Fermi surface is shown in the textbooks to lead to a resistivity that goes as T squared. So that's the ordinary metal with a resistance that's T squared. Okay, so finally then we turn our attention to the remaining elephant in the room, which is this red region in between. And that, for want of a better word, is called a strange metal. because it's a metal, but it has a resistance. One of its strange properties is the resistance has an exponent alpha, which is close to 1. But there are many other properties that are strange. And really, one of the big challenges in condensed matter theory is really coming up with a complete theory of such strange metal and how these other phases descend from them as you lower the temperature. So that's still an open question, but here I want to make an analogy between this kind of phase diagram and a phase diagram I drew earlier for my coupled dimer antiferromagnet. There I had nail order going to a quantum paramagnet. Here I have metals on all the sides, and in fact even superconductors. And out here I have ordinary metal. And so one possibility is that this strange metal that we're seeing in this phase diagram is in fact associated with this quantum critical point where magnetic order disappears. So there is a quantum critical point where antiferromagnetism disappears, and perhaps it's that critical point, now in a metal, not in an insulator, that's responsible for the strange metal behavior. If so, then it seems quite justifiable to claim that here again we are dealing with a state, the strange metal is a state which fundamentally is talking about system with long-range entanglement. And the theories that we have, although incomplete, of this critical point certainly bear that out in two dimensions. Okay. All right, so then the key problem we have to figure out, as I've already said, is to figure out how antiferromagnetism interplays with metallic behavior and what kinds of entanglement novel states do we get. Okay, so that's really largely an open problem. But this problem motivates, you know, a challenge to string theory, which is, you know, we're not going to try to explain this experiment. We just want right now some broad understanding of different types of critical points and phases of metals. We think we have pretty good understanding of insulators, and I showed you one example which has a conformal field theory at a critical point. But in metals, what happens in metals? Can you understand metallic states? And I'm happy to give the string theorists the license to take any metal you want, take any bunch of particles with all kinds of forces except gravity, and get something that's not a Sommerfeld block Landau metal. That sounds, you know, harder than it seems, because in condensed matter we don't have any fully understood examples. There is quite a lot understood, but it's still not a complete story in condensed matter. Okay, so the question is, can we obtain holographic or gravitational theory? Well, okay, before you go there, sorry. Can you get theories of ordinary superconductors and Sommerfeld block metals or Landau Fermi liquids? So that would seem like the first step. And the answer only recently has been indeed yes. There are now holographic theories which precisely reproduce all the known properties of ordinary superconductors and typical Fermi liquids. So then the next question becomes, do you get any other metals from other than Sommerfeld block metal? So remember, as I said, in condensed matter, this turned out to be a very difficult and still, in a sense, unsolved problem. But here you run into the opposite problem. In fact, you get infinite numbers of them when you just take a naive application of holographic and just make the system metallic by changing the density of the carriers. And they have lots of strange properties. So now the challenge to string theory is really the opposite. There aren't too few answers, there's too many of them. And you have to figure out which of them are actually answering the question that we wanted to answer. So you have to try to restrict these many strange metals that have been appearing every day on the archive on FTH. So how do we discard the artifacts and choose the holographic theories applicable to condensed matter physics? The short answer is we don't know. I mean, this is really the key question right now. It's nice to have so many examples now, but how do we decide that this is actually a reasonable model or something that could happen in some kind of Hamiltonian that condensed matter theorists might work with? There's no answer to this, but in very recent work, we've made a proposal that at least one restriction is that they have the right entropy density and also the right behavior of the entanglement entropy. And this turns out to very strongly restrict the class of theories, and these restricted theories also turn out to have a lot of nice properties, including the Fermi surface, at least the deduced Fermi surface size seems to be reasonable. But anyways, this is all still work in progress, and we're having a lot of fun to try to answer these questions. You know, we've come a lot way, I think, in even the last 2 or 3 years, and so I'm optimistic we'll get even closer in the near future. Anyway, okay, so I had a part here where I actually did some calculations, but I'm going to skip that. So let me just go to my conclusions. To answer your question, if you want to see a metric, that's kind of what it looks like. Here I was going to just describe this recent work, restricting the class of strange metals that are semi-realistic from our point of view. Okay, so to conclude, so what I've tried to argue is that the exciting things about condensed matter physics is that there are many new phases of quantum matter where quantum entanglement, and especially long-range entanglement, is really the crucial feature that we have to account for to understand many experiments, and this is something that is just entirely missing from the canonical condensed matter textbooks. So the simplest examples of long-range entanglement, which we now understand reasonably well, are these special quantum critical points of insulating antiferromagnets, and I gave you one example of it. But the more experimentally, there's so many more examples in metallic systems. But there, you know, the condensed matter theory really runs into many challenges, and especially in two dimensions. It does seem like these kind of critical points in metals are crucial to much of the physics, but we don't have a complete theory of what's going on in these states. And these new ideas from string theory are giving us a whole new perspective and a different way of thinking about these very complicated states. Thank you very much.